From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with baseball great Willie Mays. His 22-year career in the big leagues earned him a place in the Hall of Fame and in the memories of countless baseball fans. Also today, I speak with man on the street Mal Sharp, a master at asking ordinary people extraordinary questions. And we have reviews of Prince's new album, Love Sexy, and of Dennis Hopper's new movie, Colors. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Baseball has had many players who've been great at one thing. My guest, Willie Mays, is one of those rarest of greats. During his 22 years as a major leaguer, he was exceptional at all facets of the game. Slugging, running, fielding, throwing. In general, an all-round spectacular player. Some say the best. Mays retired at the end of the 1973 season with nearly 3,000 games and 660 home runs under his belt. After he retired, he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame the first year he was eligible. That's an honor that's only been given to a handful of players. Willie Mays has just written his autobiography. It's called Say Hey, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Willie Mays, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, man.
You spent most of your life out in center field, and I'm curious about what you liked, what it was like out there, what you liked about it.
Well, I think you have it all wrong. I didn't spend my life in center field. I was a player in center field, but my life was involved at the other eight players. And I think when you do that, I think sometimes people that doesn't know about baseball get it all wrong. I was one of the type of guys that had to worry about eight guys. So in center field, I was more just a player. I was involved in like a manager or whatever, you know, involvement.
Well, you I know, describe center field as a kind of playground or backyard, that you talked about it as a kind of backyard. And obviously it was a place where, center field is where someone has to be able to run.
And, yeah, center field.
And cover a lot of territory.
Center field have to be a guy that want to move, want to just about catch all the balls, involvement there. And I played in ballparks like the Polo Ground, which was a big center field, and I loved it. Then I went to San Francisco. I had at the beginning, I had a short center field. Then they built a big one so I could run a little bit. And I think most guys that you see play center field are quick guys. I mean, quick or fast, and want to do a lot of things. The left field and right field are so-so guys. They're the guys who want to cover the line. And I think the center fielder, he's got to cover everything, you know.
Well, now, in high school, you played for the Birmingham Black Barons, which was in the Negro League.
Yes.
And obviously it was a time when there were separate black and white baseball leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how different it was. And you describe some of what you had to contend with because you were in a country that was very segregated at the time.
And well, it's still segregated in certain ways, you know. But when I came along, we had our own league in Birmingham. We had about 16 teams in different cities, Kansas City, Memphis, Little Rock, Philadelphia. Philadelphia had a thing called the Philadelphia Stars here. And we had our own little World Series in Chicago during the All-Star break. But it didn't bother me because I played when I was 14, so I didn't bother me just being, you know, segregated or whatever. But when I came to Trenton, New Jersey, I had a little bit of that in my first, I'll say, week, because Jacket had already came in 1947, so it had to begin to loosen up a little bit when I came, you know, came to the Giants. But the only problem I had was in Hagerstown, Maryland, and it wasn't really a big problem. It's just some name calling, which I had already been programmed for that, and it wasn't that bad because by Sunday coming, I had already got about 9 or 10 hits, so they didn't bother me anymore.
You know. You were about 16 when Jackie Robinson broke into the majors. What did that mean to you? I mean, you were a talented. I mean, people were recognizing your talent, and you were still a young man. And what did that mean to you when someone like Jackie Robinson broke into the majors?
Well, it mean just like Joe Louis was a boxer. He was the greatest black boxer with Sugar Ray Robinson. Jackie broke in, and when he broke in, it was like we know we can get to the majors, just we ever had a chance. And for 2 years, Jackie had to be very patient. You know, and he couldn't fight, he couldn't do anything. And when he came in, if you notice, black players began to come in very quickly. So that's why we admire Jackie so much, because we know the hardships that he had in each town that he went to. So what it means to me that, hey, I think I'm going to make a good living if I just keep on playing. And we recognize that in Jackie Robinson.
I think you said about him that he was the first who didn't pretend not to be black.
Very much so. Jackie was a man that knew that he was black, and no one could tell him anything different. He spoke very, very well. He was well-educated coming out of California, I think of UCLA. And he was the type of guy that when you start talking black and white, he's always there. He was the type of guy who would fight for the blacks all the time, you know. So, yes, I would have to say that.
I would think in those days, and it's true to a certain extent in these days, that it's dangerous to be black and proud. I mean, that he had to had to walk a very fine line because...
You mean in these days?
Well, I was thinking mostly in those days.
Oh, okay, in those days. Well, I don't know. I was a positive thinker all my life, but I know what you're saying, because when I came to the majors, we couldn't stay with the whites, so we had to stay in different hotels. But I was the guy hitting the home runs, so I knew, even though I was hitting the home runs, that they had a problem as far as race was concerned. But again, I was programmed before I got here, so it didn't bother me that much to come to the majors and not being able to, you know, to stay with the people.
How did you get the nickname, the Say Hey Kid?
Well, that's when I first came up in 1951, and I didn't know any of the guys' names, and I would start calling them Say Hey, and I started hitting home runs, and the different people around the country started calling me Say Hey, and the writers just gave me the Say Hey Kid, and it just stuck with me all these years.
Do you like the name?
Well, if I didn't, I wouldn't use it.
You, I know, had a very impressive batting average in the minors, and it was 477, and the major leagues got interested in you. And when the Giants called you, you turned them down. You said,
no, I didn't turn them down. I told Leo, he called me in a place called Sioux City, Iowa. You don't turn people down like when they call you up. You make suggestions, you know, like I said to Leo, I don't think I want to come up. I think I would like to stay in the minors to see what I can do for the whole year. But they had lost 13 out of 14 games, and they needed a refreshing guy to come up. And he said, well, if you're hitting 477 here, can you hit 250? I said, yeah, I can hit that. So he convinced me that they needed me here. But you don't do that when you're in the minors. When they call you up, you should be ready to come and play regardless of what do you play. You got to be there.
Well, when you started playing in the majors, you were a young man. You were 20 years old, and
I just turned 20 when I came to the majors in New York. Actually, my first game was here in Philadelphia, and I was on a Friday, and I played three games here and didn't do that well. But we won all three games, and that's the bottom line: win. And they didn't bother me, but I was getting upset myself. And when I went back to the clubhouse, I was all upset, and Leo gave me a lot of confidence in playing center field, and he said to me that as long as I'm here or you here, you're going to be my center fielder. And I think that helped me tremendous to take a little load off my shoulders, you know, about going back to the minors I'm talking about, you know. So I think he played a great deal of part in me, you know, being in baseball.
Do you think of him as a sort of father-son relationship? Because I think
he was.
Yeah, that he certainly thought of you as his son and had.
Well, he and Lorraine Day, which was a movie star at that time, taking me in their homes many times. His kid, Chris DeRocha, used to be my roommate on the road, and they would bring him to New York and leave him with me for like two weeks and. I used to take him on the road, eat what I used to eat, and he didn't like it sometimes, but that's the way it was. You know, he would go back and tell his father I didn't feed him or something, and then that way his father would give us extra money so we can have a steak or something. So it worked out fine for me, you know.
My guest is baseball great Willie Mays. There were several people, several men, several managers that really took an interest in you. What did they see in you? I mean, you were obviously a great baseball player, but did they see perhaps...
You mean before I started? I mean, it wasn't a lot of managers bother me after Leah. They might have taken an interest in me, but they couldn't show me nothing. I was very, I would say I had a sixth sense of doing everything my own way, but it might have been a unique type of way. But after Leo, I didn't have a lot of managers take an interest in me, if you're talking about showing me what to do and how to do it. Herman Franks was a guy that said to me, okay, you can take care of the field. That means I manage the field, I manage the bench. And Alvin Dock made me the first black captain of the ball club. So when you say interest, it's not like Leo took an interest in me. It was a combination type of thing. Okay, I'm going to make you the captain. And the press played it up because I was the first black. And Herman knew that I could handle the field much better than he, and he let me do that. So that was the interest that they'd taken part of in.
Where did you learn the basket catch?
I learned that when I was in the service. I was in the service 52, 53, and I really didn't have that much to do. I was like a PT instructor or whatever. You know, I didn't do much of that either because I played ball every day. We had a schedule of about 90 games, and I said to myself, I need to have something when I come back to the game, and I tried the basket catch, and when I came back, they started calling it the bread basket catch. So I said, oh, no, that's not what I call it. So we used it just a basket catch. And I found out that I could do more that way than I could over my shoulders. But that is not the correct way of catching a baseball. You know, I wouldn't teach that way.
Well, I would think part of the problem or part of what you have to contend with is you don't see the ball going into your glove.
You don't want to see the ball go in your glove because you got your head's got to be up when you catch that. See, I couldn't teach that to you. Because it was something very unusual that I would do, and if you didn't practice at it, you try to watch the ball in the glove. You don't watch it. You watch it when it goes by the eye level, and when it goes by, you don't just look down because if you do, you lose all sight on what you're going to do and how you're going to throw it. So it's a very difficult thing to do.
Is it also easier somehow from that position to then toss the ball, to throw the ball where you want to throw it?
Well, it's got to be what I call one piece. The ball, as you know, downgrade. And when you downgrade, you just bring it around all in the same one motion. But it's, like I say, it's very difficult for me to try and explain to you or tell you because it was a very unusual type of catching, you know.
But somehow it fit your physique or the way that you played the game.
I made it fit, and I found out it was easier for me to do it than to catch it above my shoulder.
I suppose your fans still remember about your catch in the 1954 World Series.
Yeah, they talk about that because it was in the World Series, and I think that was a turning point in 1954 when we had the World Series, and I think people still talk about it because a lot of people were there, and it was the World Series. And I think when they do talk about it, it keeps me going a lot of times as far as visibility. And I made better catches than that during the course of a season. But, of course, nobody saw it because we didn't have that much television in those days. But this was in the World Series, and thousands of people saw the game.
Well, what you did was to kind of catch the ball over your shoulder.
Well, it's not that easy.
See, no, I know that.
You sometimes think about catching just a ball over your shoulder. That see, I didn't catch it that way. It was a lot of things happening all in one motion where you got to catch the ball, throw the ball, and you got to throw it on target to a certain base. That's a whole three pieces there where you got to do. And first, you got to catch the ball. Then you got to throw it. Then you got to think. As you're running, and that's what I did. As I'm running, I'm thinking what I'm going to do with this ball before I ever catch it. And now if I miss it, then you got to think about that too. So you got to think as you're running what you're going to do.
But you don't think that was your greatest catch?
No. Well, I made better catches than that. You know.
One thing you did, which I find is interesting, and to me sort of plays into the dramatic elements that baseball has. I mean, baseball is a sport, but to me it's also a very dramatic kind of thing. You're watching the way these guys play on the field. And you used to wear a cap that was too big for your head.
Too small.
Too small for your
Not
head.
Not too big, too small. The reason for that is that I was an entertainer, And when you are an entertainer, you try and do things that people understand and they relate to you. They related the cap, the catch, and the base running all to myself because I did something different. I wasn't just an ordinary base runner, ordinary guy in the field catching the ball. And every time I ran, my cap would fly off. And one time I was catching the ball and catching my hat all at the same time. So you have to understand that the writers look for things like that, and they write it the way they see it.
But is it also a way of controlling the game? I mean, the pace of the game, because you'd have to go back and pick up your hat.
No, we had guys for that.
You had guys who could do that for you?
The guy that comes behind me, he's supposed to do that. Sometimes I would leave it and then bring it back, you know, because the guys would pick it up, for me.
You many times really collapse from exhaustion.
Yes.
I mean, you played with your body and soul, with your whole self. Were people afraid that you were going to burn out?
Well, no, I had no problem about burning out. That's the way I played. I played 22 years, and I asked the doctor a couple of times, why was I falling out? And that's what he gave me. It was fatigue, mainly. Every year I would fall out around July, and they would send me to the hospital and give me all kinds of vitamins and B12s and things and get myself back together. If you look at the stats or statistics on my playing ability each year, you will see that the most games I miss, maybe two, maybe three games a year, and that's not a lot of game out of 154 or 162 games. So when the doctor explained to me that it's fatigue, then I didn't worry no more because I knew it was coming. But when you're in a pennant race, they couldn't afford not to have me on the ball club or on the field. So I had to play until I fell out, and when I fell out, they dragged me out and put me in the hospital, and that's it.
My guest is baseball great Willie Mays. We're going to talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Willie Mays, one of the most all-round players in the history of baseball. In his 22 seasons in the major leagues, he played in all 21 All-Star games, batted over 300, and hit 660 home runs. His autobiography, Say Hey, has just been published. When the Giants moved out to San Francisco in 1957, the San Francisco fans were cool to you. In fact, I think there was an article in the paper that said that they cheered Khrushchev and booed Willie Mays. How hard was that for you, or what was that like for you to play in a place that was not as warm to you, perhaps, as your fans and critics and sports writers in New York were?
That didn't bother me. No. If you look at the stats in 1958, I had one of my best seasons. I hit .348. I hit 29 home runs. That, to me, I was trying to tell them, hey, you don't bother me. I'm going to play my game regardless. But I didn't feel that they had to boo me. That was my hometown people. And I felt that whatever they did, they got to be with me. It had taken me 2 years to win them over, and I really didn't think I had to because what they were saying to me, you coming from New York, now show me, which I had played already in the major. I have shown a lot of people that I could play baseball, and I don't know the reason for that, you know, and I really don't talk about it that much because that's in the past. I still live in San Francisco, and I think I'm going to stay there. But it was just one of those things. I think they wasn't used to Major League Baseball. They was used to the Coastal League at all times, and when a Major League club came out, especially a guy like myself, better than Joe the manager, which was live in the city, and he was my idol, but they didn't, you know, stop to find out. Didn't bother me at all to say, hey, we're going to pick Orlando Cepeda for the most favorite player in the first year. And I didn't say nothing. I just went on and played my game. Next year I had a better year. So you can't continue doing misusing a guy that's playing every day and playing good. So that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, you played for yourself then. I mean, you didn't.
No. I didn't play for myself. I played. Myself was easy. The other eight guys, it wasn't easy because sometimes you have to tell each guy in different position what to do and how to do it, because sometimes they get nervous, and you got to know who gets nervous and not. Same as a hitter. You got to know what he can hit and what he can't hit. A pitcher know what to throw and when to try and hit it. So I myself never really got excited too much when I played baseball, you know.
You talk about Candlestick Park out mm-hmm. there and the wind.
Yeah.
And how you had to really readjust for the wind.
Not me. I had a beat. I played center field very well in San Francisco. I was there to actually, people that came into the ballpark had a problem, not me. I would have a beat. Like, for instance, in San Francisco, if you hit a ball to left center, it was a count there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the ball, by the time you get to move, the ball is coming down to you. But certain guys came out of another climate, they would go to the ball where they think the ball was going to be. But the wind blew so hard that it would blow it to right center without any problem. And that's why they had problems there. They didn't know how the wind would blow, and they didn't know what to do and how to play it. You know?
So you would watch the ball count and see where the wind would take it, and then you knew where to go.
I knew where to go before the ball that was hit. So you can't wait all that. That's too long. You gotta move, and you gotta move on time. You know, if you don't play the center field, these are things I'm telling you are very difficult to understand, because you don't have a knack of saying to yourself, "Well, gee, I'm gonna count 1, 2, 3." That's not that way you play. You count 1, 2, 3 and just move slowly. Mm-hmm. But you're watching the ball all the same time, and it's gonna blow where you stop counting that. And most people, if they count, they're going to go to the ball, and the ball is never going to come. They're going to be where they just left.
One thing I know that all sports players have to contend with is when to retire. And I think mm-hmm. what is difficult about sports players is that perhaps when you're in your prime, perhaps mentally, I think that when we're 35, we all sort of hit our stride. Oftentimes for sports players, they're not in their prime when it comes to their body. And I was wondering how you dealt with that, how you knew when to retire or when not to retire.
First of all, you don't know.
You don't.
I think most players try to play as long as they can, and I think they should. I was told that I played too long my last 2 years. I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Well, I think I enjoyed the game as much as I did when I was 19, but I couldn't play the game as well as I was 19. But I said to the writers and many times, I played for 22 years, now you got to give me 2 years. Hmm. So they did, and I always thanked them because I didn't have the opportunity to play like I should. Plus, I was traded. I think if I had stayed with the Giants, I wouldn't have had no problem playing. The new environment, when you go there, you try so hard to do something for your new ball club, but the body won't let you do it. So if I had stayed with San Francisco, I could have played 3 or 4 games a week, and I would have had no problem playing. But it was just one of those things. And I think I played as long as I wanted to play. And I think you see guys now playing up to 45, 40 without any problem. And nobody's saying nothing. Hmm. But they're making money, which I think they should play as long as they can, as long as they enjoy the game, as long as the people sign them.
When you retired from baseball, you began to work for Bally's.
No. When I retired, I stayed with the Mets for 5 years. And then after the 5th year, I was approached by Al Rosen and a guy by the name of Mr. Billy Weinberger. Mm-hmm. And that was in 79. And they asked me, would I come to Atlantic City? And I said, I have to check with the commissioner because, as you know, gambling and baseball doesn't, you know, go together too cool. And
Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner back
Bowie
then.
Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner then, and he ruled that I had to leave baseball to go to Atlantic City, in which I didn't think it was right. But then when you look at it, he is the commissioner. He had the right to say whatever he wanted. Still, I often tell him that wasn't right because I was only going there to do the PR work, because in gambling, they don't need me to gamble. They're going to gamble anyway. You know?
Well, I think he was afraid that somehow your image would somehow tarnish, I suppose, the image of other baseball players because you were associated with...
No, that's not so, because we had been going to Vegas 7 years, going to the Dooms Hotel and playing in golf tournaments the same as I do when I go to Atlantic City. So that was no trying to tell a ball player what to do. They're going to do what they want to do anyway.
Sure.
And I said to the commissioner that we've been going. He said, well, I know that. I said, well, then is this the same thing I'm going to do? I'm just getting paid for it. So he ruled that I couldn't go, and I think I just, you know, left it at that and didn't bother with it. Then when Peter Uberoff came in, he said the same thing that I said. Why shouldn't you be able to make a living if you're not doing anything wrong? I like to know what I'm doing. So he called, and they assured him that I wasn't involved in gambling. They don't need me for that. They need me to play golf with the people and maybe go to dinner with people sometime and just do the PR work.
In 1979, you were inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And you said at the time, I think I was the best baseball player I ever saw.
No, that was a reason for that. That was a guy that was a writer, and I was talking, and this was in New York, and they kept asking me, who's the best baseball? So I ignored him for about, 5 minutes, and all of a sudden in my mind, what do you use for a headline? Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, the headline is going to be Willie Mays says he's the best baseball player in the world. And that's the reason I said it. Never have I said that again because I don't do that. That's not my style of talking. But I looked at a headline. I knew what the headline was going to be the next day before it came out. And I said to the writer, would you repeat what you said, sir? He said, well, then who's the best baseball player? And I said, Willie Mays. Mm-hmm. And right away, the next headline, because I knew what they were looking for. You know, they didn't have a headline, see. But I never really talk about myself when it comes to playing because I think the fans do that enough for themselves.
What do you miss about baseball?
I don't miss anything about baseball. I played 22 years. I enjoy what I did, and I think I did it well. And I don't try and look back. I don't try to pick up time. When you try and look back, you worry too much. And I know I worry about baseball. It took me 2 years to get off of the field. And now I don't want to have to start worrying all over again about it. So I don't look back. I don't even watch films of myself. It just reminds me of too much of getting back on the field. So I try and stay away from it as much as I can. Yeah.
Well, Willie Mays, I thank you very much for talking with us today.
Sure. Thank you very much.
My guest has been baseball great Willie Mays, one of the best players in the history of baseball. His autobiography, Say Hey, has just been published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll hear from Jay Stevens. His book, Storming Heaven, charts the 40-year history of the hallucinogen, LSD. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is off today. Coming up, I speak with Man on the Street interviewer Mal Sharp. He's to journalism what a group of breakdancers is to the Kirov Ballet. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Love Sexy, the new album from Prince. And guest film critic Michael Schrago reviews Colors, Dennis Hopper's new movie about big city gang violence. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Colombian drug runner Carlos Lader, a leader of Colombia's biggest cocaine cartel, has been convicted by a jury in Florida on charges that could send him to jail for life. Alan Tomlinson reports from Jacksonville.
Midway through the seventh day of their deliberations, the jury returned guilty verdicts on all 11 charges against Lader. Collectively, they are almost sure to earn him life imprisonment without parole. After the verdict, U.S. Attorney Robert Merkel said triumphantly,
"This is a victory for the good guys, and by the good guys, I mean the American people."
According to the prosecution, Lader has done for cocaine what Henry Ford did for the motor car. He transformed it from an exotic luxury to something anyone can afford. He told Colombia's big cocaine producers to forget the yuppies and go for the ghettos. They gave him their coke, and he moved it in bulk to the United States through a giant smuggling pipeline. Out of Lader's vision grew the powerful and ruthless Medellin cartel, which has destabilized Colombia and flooded American streets with cheap narcotics. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Tomlinson in Jacksonville.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today Vice President George Bush's apparent break with the president on how to handle Panama's General Manuel Noriega is, quote, fine with us. Bush, who has clinched the Republican presidential nomination, said yesterday if he were president, he would not bargain with drug dealers. The White House reportedly has agreed to drop drug charges against Noriega as part of a package aimed at getting him to step down as head of Panama's defense forces. Senate Majority Leader Robert Byrd today added his voice to the growing calls for Attorney General Edwin Meese to step down. The West Virginia Democrat held a news conference on Capitol Hill where he offered President Reagan this advice on what to say to his appointees.
It seems to me that any president ought to be willing and ought to say to any person whom he is about to appoint to an agency or department, now you are my friend. I believe in you. I have full confidence in you. But if your actions are such as to put that office under a cloud and you under a cloud, the public interest comes first. And you'll have to leave.
Byrd said Meese's continuing legal problems are affecting Justice Department operations and that public confidence in that department is more critical than President Reagan's often stated confidence in Meese. Jesse Jackson is suggesting that racist comments by what he calls irresponsible public officials helped create the climate for an alleged assassination plot against him. The Democratic presidential candidate was apparently referring, in part, to remarks by New York Mayor Ed Koch, who said during the New York primary campaign that Jews would have to be crazy to vote for Jackson because of his support for the PLO. In St. Louis, a married couple has been charged with plotting to kill Jackson, allegedly because he was getting too close to being president. Both Jackson and Democratic frontrunner Michael Dukakis were campaigning in California today, ahead of Tuesday's primary. The leading industrialized nations tried today to remove differences on economic and farm policies, but foreign ministers of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development countries warned that long-term answers still need to be found to reduce global trade imbalances. The ministers ended a two-day conference in Paris today, saying the prospects for economic growth in the near future look good, but they say unemployment will remain high in Europe. A bitter transatlantic dispute over ending the practice of paying huge subsidies to farmers in rich countries stalled agreement on the OECD's final communique. Stock prices closed mixed on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 7 points to close at 1958.72. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock star Prince makes music that is funky and danceable. It's also sexy, indiscreet, and controversial. He's just released a new album called Love Sexy. That's one word. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
No rock star as teasingly great as Prince. No innovative pop musician who is more likely to be dismissed as a jerk. Prince is as uncompromising in his eccentricity as he is in his musicianship. This is a fact that's never been clearer than it is on his new album. On the cover of Love Sexy, Prince is posed against a swirl of oversized purple orchids that look like they could have been painted by Alex Katz. Prince himself is naked, his lifted left leg ensuring a minimum of modesty. He's looking off in the distance, holding his right hand over his heart, as if pledging allegiance to the weird.
Welcome to the new power generation. The reason why my voice is so clear is there's no smack in my brain.
That's No I, the first song on Love Sexy, and a statement of principles in a way. Beneath that sharp, precise funk music, Prince speaks about knowing there's both a heaven and a hell, and later in the tune he sings these four lines. I know there is a devil because he talks so loud. He makes you do things your friends do, hang out with the crowd. But my Lord, he's so quiet when he calls your name. When you hear it, your heart will thunder. You'll want to hear it every day. This is sweet verse about a faith I think Prince believes in deeply. He has written similar sentiments again and again over the course of 10 years of record making. But how does that faith square with posing nude among the orchids, with writing songs so sexually explicit I can't play them on the radio? This has been an ongoing paradox in Prince's career, and Love Sexy is his attempt at an answer. That's the album's title song. And we have to come to terms with this awkward neologism, Love Sexy. It's clear from his music that Prince doesn't think it's contradictory or even a sin to be both a Christian and a libertine, to run pure thoughts through a dirty mind. This is nothing new, of course. Artists ranging from Elvis Presley to D.H. Lawrence have had a similar notion. In this sense, all Love Sexy means is a commingling of the spiritual and the sexual, that indeed sex is the most direct route to the spiritual. Prince seems to perceive this as a radical agenda for pop songs in 1988, and he's probably right. Lots of rock acts try to shock, but none of them backs up the naughtiness with music as obsessive as Prince.
So much for your every kiss. I That's I Wish You Heaven. With this album, Prince confirms again that he's our most unlikely rock star. His willful obscurity and oddball posturing prevents fans from identifying with him, the way Bruce Springsteen fans can feel at one with the boss. And by filling his songs with references to his tussles with religion, by persistently comparing an impending nuclear war to Armageddon, Prince denies himself the pop star lightness and charm of Michael Jackson. No one is pursuing eccentricity with such arrogant boldness and self-absorption while reaching so many people. Weirdo or not, I think that's admirable.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
It's time for new education. Former rules don't apply. We need a power structure that be production instead of jacks who vandalize.
What's happening?
This is Fresh Air. If someone came up to you on the street corner with a microphone and tape recorder and asked you about the meaning of life or your favorite fish, what would you say? Would you think the guy was nuts? If the guy was Mal Sharpe and you wanted to take a chance, maybe you would stop and talk. Since the early 60s, Mal Sharpe has been doing man-on-the-street interviews, mostly around San Francisco, where he lives. Sharpe has made a career out of asking people zany questions. He's put together radio and TV shows and lots of commercials. He's also cut two albums for Rhino Records. I asked him how he got started.
Oh, I don't know. I just sort of fell into this. I studied radio and television in college, but I always thought I was going to be a producer or a writer. And then I came out to San Francisco just to kill time when I got out of school and lived in this boarding house and met this sort of lunatic, Jim Coyle. And we just, kind of started hanging out together, putting people on. And then as an alternative to going to work, we decided to record it and just ended up doing this for the rest of my life. I ever planned.
Now, can you spot a good interview when you're standing on the street corner? I assume you have a kind of a trained eye. And when you see someone walking towards you, can you tell if this is going to be something good or not?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of indicators, and I think, if anybody did this, they begin to spot it themselves. One, as you're standing on the street trying to be nonchalant with your microphone, you can hear, if three guys are coming down the street, one of them's always louder than the other. That guy will probably be the best interview in the group. If I'm standing there with a mic and I look someone in the eye and they look back at me, instead of avert their gaze, as a lot of pickpockets and felons will in the streets of San Francisco, there's a good chance this person will be pretty good. You can tell a lot by body language.
Well, I think it's true that there are people who will gravitate towards a microphone or a television camera on the street, and those that really shy away. And I don't know if they're felons and pickpockets, the ones that shy away, but there are.
Yes, they all are.
Oh, they are.
Or would-be felons.
But I'm wondering whether the reluctant interviewee wouldn't be at least as interesting as the willing interviewee.
You have your reluctant person who basically isn't so reluctant, but I find reluctant people don't, they really do want to be reluctant. And if I find somebody's reluctant, I generally don't try and pursue them. I think people have a right to a certain privacy, you know, and protection from the man on the street.
Where do you have a favorite spot?
I don't have favorites. I have favorite spots, yeah, and I don't know what it is. Certain corners are very productive, and other corners aren't. I don't know what it is, but if you were to hire me today to do something here in San Francisco or ask me to go out and do something for you, there's several places I would go, and if you came with me, you'd say, gee, this is really a lively spot.
Well, I know you go to trade shows, you go to conventions, you went to the Republican convention and asked these Republicans what their favorite fish was.
Mr. Chairman, my fellow delegates, it is now my great honor and privilege to nominate the next president of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Okay, this is exciting. Ronald Reagan has just been nominated. I'm going to walk around now and capture some of the excitement here. How you doing? What excite? You excited about Reagan?
Oh, I love Reagan.
What's your favorite fish?
I love my favorite fish.
How about you, sir? What's your favorite fish?
Rock.
What?
Rock.
What?
Rock fish.
Rock fish. Okay. How you doing?
Different.
What are you saying over here? Are you excited about Reagan?
Of course we're excited.
You like the nomination?
Very much so.
What's your favorite vegetable?
What's that got to do with Reagan?
What's your favorite vegetable?
What difference? Asparagus. Well, what's that got to do with Reagan?
Okay, well, the cheering is dying down now, and I think we have a new candidate, and we have a new favorite vegetable, which is asparagus. Let's go back to the station.
This fish question is part of a series of kind of fallback questions that you have, the others being, are you happy with your toaster, and what's the meaning of life, and do airplanes really fly? I think you asked somebody that. And I'm wondering whether you're looking for some connection between toast and existentialism.
You know, there probably is more meaning in talking to people about their toasters than talking to them about what's going on in their life right now. I mean, I think people reveal something about themselves when you ask them about their toasters.
Now, you do television work, I know, and have had some television specials. And I'm wondering whether being seen doesn't blow your cover, and whether there's a chance of, if people know who you are, if they recognize you, then the gag doesn't work.
You know, it's interesting. If you're doing a hidden camera piece and you're not standing around with a microphone and they can't see a camera, let's say you're inside a dry cleaning store, and you come out to wait on a customer, they just don't connect you with someone they've heard on television or seen on the radio.
Even if they've seen you and heard you?
Yeah, often. Or sometimes they'll go, aren't you the guy on television? And you just go, yeah. Now, and then you just continue on. You know, they hand you their dry cleaning slip, and you say, I'll be right back. And then you go in the back room, and you come out, and you bring out a vacuum cleaner. And they say, well, I didn't bring a vacuum cleaner in to be cleaned. I brought dry cleaning in. And you say, we don't do dry cleaning anymore. We're working on vacuum cleaners. Now, they know. You know, you've already told them you're the guy on TV, but that's history. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
They just, you get them involved in something, and it doesn't seem to matter.
Well, I've seen what you look like. You're a big guy, and I know that I think it was someone in the New Yorker described you as a friendly elk.
Yeah.
And is there something disarming about you that people will talk to you? Is there something that's not threatening about your presence on the street?
I guess so. You know, once again, it's just sort of emotionally drawing them into this improvisation, which they surrender all these fears that this big guy has got them cornered or anything like that. They're just in it. And before they know it, they're in trouble. How you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
I'll tell you what we're talking about today. Do you think in our society that we sweep death aside too much? Do you think we're afraid to really confront the meaning of death?
I mean, nothing. You die, that's all. What the heck? I don't worry, think about death, nothing.
You know, you might be the ideal guy to help me out on this project. Because of my work, I'm a man on the street. The Food and Drug Administration has given me one dead body. What I would like to do is place this dead body someplace where people can see it, put it on display. Where do you go for enjoyment?
I go out to Marine Land once in a while, and ball games. Sometimes I walk out to the ball game.
If I give you a couple bucks, would you take, you know, for the bus fare, would you take the body, take it to the ball game this week?
No, what the hell kind of a deal is that? No, I wouldn't do it under no circumstances. Whoever give you this job is just nuts, I think.
Would you have the dead body sit in its own seat or on your lap?
Well, it depends on make him stand up. He'd be stiff anyway. Or out in a ball game, too, then somebody in the back line will knock you down. Hey, sit down. Would you like to go out in a ball game and have a dead person standing in front of you? Huh? After you're paying $3.50 to get in or $2, whatever it is? No, no. I'm sorry, I gotta go.
Okay, bye now. He's looking back at me now. Excuse me, ma'am. Question of the day, meaning of life?
I know that you do commercials for AT&T, many others. Are you ever afraid that the shtick will become a cliche when the commercial, that it will be overexposed?
Well, it's interesting about commercials. The more you do them, you keep thinking it's going to be overexposed as a concept. But for some reason, the more you're on, the more that advertisers seem to like you or want you. I guess if you're believable, they just keep hiring you.
Do you like that part of it?
The part of?
Of being part of a commercial. Because there's something so irreverent about what you do on the street. And the idea of packaging it as a commercial to sell something like Hilton or AT&T makes it very different.
Not to me, really. You know, I just see all these things as creative exercises. And I try and approach it that way and do it that way. I don't really do it any differently than I do it if I was taking a dead body to a ball game. I mean, there are certain subjects you can't get into. But I don't see it that way, and I don't really do it that way. I try and do the commercials try and make them as interesting as possible.
Well, Mel Sharpe, thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot, Marty.
Mel Sharpe spoke to us from KQED in San Francisco.
But before I disappear into the crowd, I just want to give you one tip. If you're ever on the street with a microphone and you're at a loss for a good question, just walk up to somebody and say, "Hi, what's your favorite fish?
Who are you?
What's wrong with asking?"
I don't like nuts cornering me on the street.
Why
do you want to know my favorite fish? Why?
I'm the man on the street.
My favorite fish is
salmon, and this is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with host Robert Siegel and see what's coming up. Hi, Robert. What
Hello,
do you have
Marty.
For us?
Well, we'll have a report from Tom Gelton on the Panamanian Defense Force, which has given the country not only General Noriega, but before that, Omar Torrijos. And he explains why the PDF will probably dominate Panamanian politics even after Noriega. We also have an interview with British jazz singer Cleo Lane, and we check in to find out just how open the policy of openness, or glasnost, appears to be in Moscow nowadays after the detention of the editor of an independent magazine and a letter criticizing government policy from Andrei Sakharov.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Street gangs are a fact of life. Dennis Hopper has just directed a film about gangs and cops in Los Angeles. It's called Colors. Guest film critic Michael Schrago has a review.
Sean Penn and Robert Duvall do their damnedest to make Colors work, but it would take a Penn and Teller magic act to lift it out of the ordinary. The stars are stuck playing the oldest roles in the book, the hot-headed young cop and the grizzled old vet. The movie is mediocre, but it's become a high-profile news item because of the violence erupting at several theaters showing it. And all this attention has helped turn it into a hit. Now, any movie that draws urban teens is bound to create a rowdy audience. So did the hateful concert film Eddie Murphy Raw. But unless you're already a gang member, the depiction of gangs in Colors doesn't go deep enough to rouse any passions. The movie makers are more interested in the cops, and they seem to think that we are too. When Penn and Duvall are assigned to be partners in a special division of the Los Angeles Police Department, the two cops struggle to work out their differences on the job. Here, Penn intimidates a criminal, and Duvall intimidates Penn.
So many handcuffs are too tight,
hey,
man.
Hey, let me do a little tap dance on your head. Shut up.
This freaking guy.
What's the matter?
I'm too old for your crap.
Well, I'm not gonna argue with that.
Oh, yeah? You think you can handle me? You think I'm over the hill? You want a friggin' piece of me?
Right now?
Huh?
You think you got the market cornered?
You think I'm not friggin' crazy? Go ahead, try me. Try me, you jerk.
Hey, Hodges. Uncle Bob. I don't have any problem with you.
Oh, no? You got problems with the whole friggin' world, and I'm in it. And I don't like it.
In that scene, Duvall tries to draw a parallel between Penn, a cop who gets high on adrenaline, and the gangs who get high on crack. But the conflicts between the cops don't provide a base to support everything the movie makers want to say about gangs, about the loyalty they engender, or the danger they pose to the community, or the disillusionment they foster in the police. When you get right down to it, this is too much of a cop movie and not enough of a gang movie. Not a single gang member emerges as a fully realized character. Maybe that's one reason for the banal title song, which has lyrics like, "My color's my honor. My game ain't knowledge, my game is fear." That's the closest the movie comes to expressing what's inside the gang members' heads. At its best, Dennis Hopper's direction does convey the booby-trapped tension of the police and gangs facing off. During the drive-by shootings, when the gangs stage hit-and-run murders, the film captures, for at least a few frightening seconds, the arbitrariness of contemporary urban horror. Drugs and the gangs that distribute them have brought the havoc of the street into the home. When one gang sprays another gang's party with bullets, one of the party animals is too stoned out to care. Details like these pin down a milieu in which there is no sanctuary. But the movie's pace flags whenever the gang's cars speed away. Too often in Colors, the movie makers give up trying to explore anything except the cliched relationship of the two lead cops. In the final scene, Hopper tries to persuade us that the baton has passed from the street diplomat played by Duvall to the hothead played by Penn, as if to say that the good fight must go on. That's when this ostensibly hard-hitting movie shows what it's really about, the survival of the most powerful gang of all, the cops.
Michael Schrago is movie critic for the San Francisco Examiner.
Color. I am a nightmare walking, psychopath talking. King of my jungle, just a gangster stalking. Living life like a firecracker, quick as my fuse. Been dead as a death, back the colors I choose. Red or blue, cuz of blood, it just don't matter. Sucker died for your life when my shotgun scatters. Color. The gangs of L.A. will never die. Just multiply colors. Color.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll hear from composer and accordionist Guy Klusevic. He first supported himself by playing polkas in bars in the steel towns of western Pennsylvania, but now he's bringing the accordion into the avant-garde. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle will continue her salute to Irving Berlin with two songs that Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire made famous. And Ken Tucker will review three movies directed by Paul Morrissey and produced by Andy Warhol. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cowain. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.